Hello, members. Matt McNeil in with another one of the members-only interviews. We really have been having a great time with these, and we're glad that you're members. We're glad to have special content for you. So make sure you check out not only this interview that you're going to be hearing here momentarily, but we've got Craig B. Upright, the grocery activism. That's going to be a brand new one for members only. Speaking of members, if I can, may I mention a few of the names here? Melanie in Minneapolis, Janice in Crystal, Candy in New Hope, Gary in Hamel, David in St. Louis Park, Diane in Georgetown, Colorado, Steve in Apple Valley, a trio from St. Louis Park, Lauren, Betty, and Brian, Nora from Minneapolis, John from Minnetonka, Orville from Chaska, and how about Gordon from Farmers Branch, Texas? Thank you very much. Once again, because of you becoming members, AM 950 will be bringing progressive programming to Minneapolis, St. Paul, through the 2020 cycle. We really do appreciate it. If you can, tell everyone to go to AM 950 Radio and become a member as well. Now, what we're also doing, not only are we doing brand new interviews, we're revisiting some of the interviews that we've done in the past that I have enjoyed. And if you've been with this station for any bit of time, you know I'm a big fan of Larry Millette. Larry, the architectural writer at one point for the Pioneer Press, he started writing books. His history books really took off with a series called Then and Now, which I don't believe was – I don't think it was his idea. It was a trend you were seeing where you would take a picture. You'd find an old picture, and you would take that picture – from the same angle only in modern day times, and then you compare the two pictures to see the changes that have happened over the 100 years, 200 years. It was a phenomenal series. And if you know me as all, I love history. I'm a huge history fan. And where I love history most of all is when I can go on out and I can see the history there. Go down to the Mill Ruins Park and then take a picture with you of the old mills that used to be down there, and you will see where the buildings used to be. That is when those workers were coming in. That's what they saw, and you can see there are still elements there. It's no different. It's a little less old, but it's no different than going to Greece or going to Rome, and you see these old ancient buildings. And from back then, they have sketches of people that drew the buildings, and you can see what they used to look like, and you can see that a lot of the times the things that have weathered the time of history. And that's one of the things I really do like. Larry, in one of his books, I always, the Washburn Mansion used to be down on the, it was, they took the entire city block just north of the MIA, Minneapolis Institute of Arts, and the park is still there. This is back, he built his mansion back in the day when there really weren't that many streetcars. I think they were just starting to build those lines back then, and it was 2 miles out of the downtown. Most of the people that worked in Minneapolis lived right in the downtown. There's a strong population center right in the city itself with a lot of working class housing and stuff, which most of it unfortunately is gone. There's a few buildings left, but not many. And the wealthy were always looking, much like in St. Paul when they eventually built the road up onto Cement Avenue, they could build houses that looked down upon people, very Gilded Age. The same thing happened. The wealthy would move to an area to kind of go be wealthy. Well, look at him. He's living way down on, 24th? Holy cow. He is 2 miles out. What a wealthy guy. He can live 2 miles out of the downtown. And he had this opulent house. I mean, it was this gorgeous house that he had downtown, down in that block. He was really the first one there. And if you go down in that block, you'll see some of the other mansions that came in quickly because wealthy people kind of started to come in there. It's like, oh, well, if he's going to be out here, I want to be out here too. I want my address to be similar to his. There are still some things you can see in that park which are remnants of the Washburn House, the old lake. They had a man-made lake. If it's on the southeast corner of the park, there's a big divot there. That was their old man-made lake there. But for the most part, most of that park is gone. I went out there with a Millette book, and I was sitting on the corner. I'm looking at the park trying to figure out, is there anything I can see here that is a remnant of history? And all of a sudden, it dawned on me. There are these big ancient trees that are there. In the photo, they're little saplings. It's the same trees that were planted years ago now in massive form, and it brought that to life for me, that the changes that had happened over time. It was a great moment. That's one of the things I love about history, and that's one of the things I love about Larry Millette, is his books have a tendency of giving you a perspective on history which you're just not going to find anywhere else. So if you don't mind, stay with us. This is an interview we originally did. It was a holiday interview in 1918. Larry Millette, his latest book was Metropolitan Dreams. We're talking about the old Metropolitan Building and the history of that. It was a great interview. Enjoy Larry Millette, a revisiting of a best of interview right here on AM 950. And thank you very much, members. We do appreciate it. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. One of my favorite authors, period. And I have pretty much every one of his books. Larry Millette is kind enough to join us today. We've interviewed him over the holidays so many times, in studio, over the phone, all the books that he's talked about. I fell in love with him with the Lost Twin Cities series, but he has written numerous buildings, including There Were Castles, Architecture and Life in Mid-Century. Once There Were Castles, I should say, Minnesota Modern Architecture and Life in Mid-Century, as well as also some great Sherlock Holmes books, which are historically set in Minneapolis, St. Paul. He's been a wonderful writer of those books as well. His latest book talks about one of the great iconic buildings of Minneapolis that no longer exists, Metropolitan Dreams, The Scandalous Rise and Stunning Fall of a Minneapolis Masterpiece. Larry Millette is kind enough to talk with us. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for the time, and congratulations on this book. I think a few interviews back, you had said you were thinking of writing a book about the Metropolitan Building, and it finally came to fruition.
It did, yeah. I actually, you know, when I wrote Lost Twin Cities now, 26 years ago it came out, still in print, by the way, the Metropolitan Building is on the cover as kind of the poster child for Lost Twin Cities, for the most famous lost building of them all. And so over the last 25 years, it's always kind of been in the back of my mind that I should maybe devote a whole book to the Metropolitan. And so I finally had a chance to do it, and Metropolitan Dreams is the result.
You know, it's really interesting, as in the when this building was built, the 1890s, there was a real push by the Western cities. You see it in San Francisco, to a point in Los Angeles, which was just starting there, as a kind of a dirt outpost. But in other cities of the West that were trying to become, you know, metropolitan meccas of the country as it developed in that time. In Minneapolis particularly, there seems to have been a real effort to create and build an iconic building that would represent the metro area, the growing city as a whole. I mean, the exhibition center was one of the buildings I know that was mentioned. There just seems like there was this big push to do that. Was that just individual developers, or was that kind of a whole mindset of trying to create something that became a spectacular visitor tourist attraction?
Well, in the case of Minneapolis, and was also true of St. Paul, the 1880s was the decade when Minneapolis really exploded into becoming a major city. And so there was a huge amount of building. I mean, thousands upon thousands of buildings were constructed in Minneapolis in the 1880s. And yes, there was a desire to really say, hey, we're a big city now, we're a real place, look at us. And so, you know, in 1889, they started building what is now called the City Hall. It was originally called the Municipal Building. And the Metropolitan Building was completed in 1890, and it really was, at least in terms of commercial architecture, the capstone of that era. I mean, this was a building that said, hey, we really are a city now, and we've got this building which will compare well. And they're right, it did, with any office building in the United States.
Talk about the initial plans here. How did the Metropolitan Building come to life?
Well, it was originally known as the Northwestern Guarantee Loan Building, and it was built for that company by a man named Louis Menage, who, as it turned out, was a crook. And he had this company that dealt in all sorts of financial things, loans, mortgages, etc. And he built a very, it was founded in the mid-1880s, and he built this company up very quickly. And the Metropolitan Building was designed to showcase the company. It was a rental office building, but he had his offices there. There were banks there. There were all sorts of different facilities in it. And Minaj wanted clearly to build the finest office building in Minneapolis to show off his riches, his firm, his success. And that's what he did. And the irony is that in 1893, in the Great Depression, his firm went belly up. I mean, belly up big time. Millions of dollars were lost. And Minaj, feeling the need to get some southern air, disappeared into Guatemala rather than be prosecuted. It's a long, tangled story. That's part of why I did the book, because the story of its creation is so fascinating, and the guy behind it, and then, of course, the story of how it ended up being needlessly demolished.
Fauché needed to learn from that.
Yes, exactly. We had another guy in Wilbur Fauché. Yeah. Minneapolis seems to have this little thing with its iconic buildings.
Why you don't build a big building in Minneapolis is because about 3 or 4 hours after you're done, guess what? This building is a gorgeous building. It's very beautiful, but there are some reminiscent elements of it. The design, am I crazy? It does remind me a little bit of the Globe Building that used to be downtown.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the same architect.
Yeah.
And E. Townsend Mix was the architect. He also did the famous William Washburn House in what is now Washburn Fair Oaks Park. He did the Globe Building in Minneapolis, and he did another building in Minneapolis called Temple Court. He was kind of the guy who introduced the light court building, the big-time light court building to the Twin Cities. His first one was the Temple Court in 1886. And of course, the Metropolitan is famous for its glass and iron light court, which was the centerpiece of the building and extended the full 12 stories. We call it an atrium, but in those days they called it a light court.
It's one of those things that obviously was gone before I was there, and the photos I've seen, it does look stunning. Was that design where they had an atrium that was that tall, was that really unique, or, I mean, was that sort of the style of the time?
It was used for lots of office buildings. The light court age was between about 1885 and 1895, and they were buildings were built that way because buildings had grown much bigger, and architects had to bring in natural light because electric lighting wasn't yet terribly reliable. So a lot of buildings were built around the United States with these light courts. Chicago had a number of them. New York, very few because of the way they had small lots and more tower-like buildings. But I believe at one time there were probably as many as 40 light court buildings of one kind or another in the Twin Cities. So it was a very common thing, but this was the father of all light courts. This was the biggest, the fanciest, the most beautiful by far. And by the time the building was torn down in 1962, I think it was still one of the last, if not the greatest, Victorian era light court left in the United States.
And the for the most part, the roof was all glass. I mean, it was a big glass apex.
Yeah, there was a big hole in the middle of the building, basically. It was a donut. And there was a skylight, which was advertised, as they always did, as the largest skylight in the Northwest. That was kind of standard practice. And then the offices were all arranged in galleries, 400 offices in all over the 12 stories. There was a full restaurant on the 12th floor. The entire 12th floor of the building was a giant restaurant. Above it was a roof garden, the first roof garden on a tall building in the Twin Cities, and maybe, I believe, one of the first roof gardens of its type in the United States. And so it really, everything about the building was just first class. It was entirely wrapped in stone. Everything was custom made for the building, all of the ironwork. It was just really a special building.
And it had that viewing platform on the very top of it. You could go up another
Had a little corner shower, and you could for a nickel or whatever it was, 25 cents, you could go up the little winding staircase. And when it was built, of course, it was the tallest building in Minneapolis. The lookout tower was 222 feet above the street, which today would be comparable to about a 20-story building. The floors were higher in those days. So, it was quite the place.
One thing, and I'm to a point a bit of a novice, am I crazy about the interior of this looks French? I mean, there at least, I mean, I've been to France, and I've been in buildings that remind me a lot of the ironworks and the steel and this kind of, like I said, there just seems to be an element of it that does feel very European when you looked at this building.
Yes, and there were certainly a lot of European buildings that had open interior light courts with iron and glass. There's the famous library in Paris, a lot of public buildings, that sort of thing. So I don't know whether Mix, the architect, was looking at anything in Europe, but he certainly would have been aware of what was going on there. And as I say, there were other buildings, white court buildings in the United States, but he was really one of the masters of that particular kind of building.
This building, a lot of the other buildings over time, I mean, the fire took out so many of the early big, you know, destination buildings in Minneapolis, especially in those from 1880 to 1910 or so. The Metropolitan did survive that. I mean, and you know, obviously it changed ownership hands a few times, I imagine, here, but it always stood. I mean, it was kind of, it become, you know, the equivalent of a Fauché. I mean, it was a building that it was kind of associated with Minneapolis for so many years.
Yeah, it was an icon, and the, you know, the kind of the tragedy of the building is that it was basically fully intact at the time it was destroyed. And I mean, almost all the original features were there in a light court. We were still running the original hydraulic elevators in 1960. You look at the photographs, late photographs of the building, and, you know, there had been some remodeling inevitably as happens in the interior of office buildings, but basically it was intact with all of its original features, which is pretty rare. The Minneapolis HRA, as part of the Gateway Center Renewal Project, just decided they had to tear it down, and they spent $1 million to tear down a building that they initially estimated the value of at less than $500,000.
Wow.
It made no sense economically. Wow. And of course, they tore it down, and then the lot stood empty for 20 years.
I mean, we want to know the truth. Is what you described, though, makes me... It does make me scratch my head. It's like, was it really only worth $500,000 when they tore it down, do you think?
Well, eventually the owner of the building went through the appeals process through the district court and the Supreme Court, and eventually got, I can't remember what the figure is, but a little over $600,000 for it. Yeah,
right.
But it cost them over $1 million to tear it down. It was a very difficult building to demolish for various reasons. The court costs were very high because they went through all sorts of lawsuits. There were a lot of protests. It was the first great historic preservation fight in Minneapolis. And so you look at it and you kind of scratch your head and you try to make sense of it, and it just doesn't make much sense.
Which is why I want to bring up a topic here that is something that's been lingering in the back of my mind. There are times where a major renovation project will go in for a metropolitan area, and then people with agendas will start saying, oh, by the way, why don't we go one additional block west or one additional block north, and we'll take out this block, not because it needs to be taken out, but because there is an ulterior motive that was in place here. You know, you talk about the fight that was involved here. You know, was this a case where the Metropolitan Building was truly needing to get taken out, or that the people at the time just said, no, this is an eyesore, it's got to go? Or, you know, how much of this Gateway project do you feel was agenda driven beyond the need for the rejuvenation of the downtown?
It's hard to say, but certainly, you know, there was a real concern about the state of the Gateway, and there were certainly buildings there that were very decrepit and that needed to be taken down. But what's odd about the whole process is the way they selected the area to be included. It was very subjective. They left the Lumber Exchange standing a few blocks away. It was actually older than the Metropolitan Building. And I think the reason they left it standing was they thought maybe it would cost them too much to tear it down. The Metropolitan Building, as far as I can tell, the reason they tore it down, they wanted it torn down, was primarily aesthetic. They felt it was an ugly building in their grand, shining new gateway. And as we all know, when the gateway got remodeled, with an exception or two, most of the stuff that was built there was, to put it bluntly, crap. and in the case of Metropolitan, of course, they didn't have a building to replace it with. It just, the site, they just had an empty lot for 20 years. So, yeah, it's a head-scratcher. But I do think one of their arguments was that the other people who were building buildings in the Gateway, new buildings, didn't want this ugly old thing nearby because it would, like, somehow taint them, you know. Here's where it gets interesting, because the HRA claimed that at least three of the new buildings that were going up, the owners said, or the developer said, you know, we can't have that. We can't have that Metropolitan Building, that old, ugly old thing there. Well, then the people who were fighting for the Met contacted those three people, and they all said, oh, no, we never said that. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, what they said in private and what they said in public, it's kind of a mystery. And I couldn't find the records of the HRA meetings from that period. It's kind of a mystery how the building was originally left out in their initial gateway plan, and then somehow it sort of crept in. So there's part of the history here that just, I don't know, we'll ever quite figure out why exactly it was included. But once they decided to include it in those boundaries, they were dead set on tearing it down, and they developed all sorts of crazy rationale for doing it. They had an assistant city building inspector who went look at the building and said, well, I don't know, you know, it's got these old stone walls. Maybe we could save it by taking out all the stones. Wow. And that's what literally held the building up. And you just kind of scratched your head and said, really? Yeah, the sad thing is, if it had been a block away by the 1970s, or certainly by the 1980s, it would have been fully restored. And it would be like the centerpiece of that whole part of Minneapolis. Yeah, and there'd be, you know, people would be saying, oh, wow, we got our offices. You know, we got our offices in the Metropolitan. Look at these. And we got the light port and the elevators and all that. So it really is sad. It's sad because there's just no reason it had to happen.
Yeah, you look at what they're doing with warehouse buildings and how coveted those are. Yeah, exactly. It's this. Yeah. This would have been, people would have driven in just to see the hydraulic elevators, for goodness sake.
Yeah, those probably would have had to have been replaced. And they, you know, they'd have to enclose the open cages and glass. There would have to have been things done. But, you know, if you look at something like the Pioneer Building in St. Paul, which still is the last building in the Twin Cities that has an office light, full height light court, you know, they restored that. It wasn't a big deal, you know. It all could have been done, but in the 1960, historic preservation was kind of not even a thing, and didn't really start developing till the 60s and then the 70s, and the timing wasn't good.
Well, and if Metropolitan Buildings really, place in history is really to be identified, it really was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was, from that point forward, people just sort of said, we're not going to do this again. We need to save these buildings if at all possible. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, no, it really was the lodestar for historic preservation movement, I think, in the Twin Cities. And it really was the first big example of sort of a popular, I'll say uprising, but there were a lot of people, architects, general public, even the janitor of the building.
Larry, you were saying even the janitor was saying that this building probably shouldn't have been torn down.
And it wasn't just, you know, architects and historians and people like that, although there were a lot of them. I mean, it was kind of just average people who had been in the building, knew it well. I went there. My dad took me there in probably about 1960, and I was maybe all of 13 years old. Everybody knew the building, and there was a lot of people who just loved that building, and so it was kind of a ground up sort of an attempt to preserve it. But there were no really good mechanisms available at that time to restore a building like that and preserve it. And the desire to redo the gateway was so powerful, especially in the city council and city leaders, that when the vote came to approve the gateway plan, which included the demolition of the Metropolitan, council voted 13-0 in favor.
But at the same time, like we mentioned, after that, though, it basically changed and people were going to preserve the buildings downtown at that point.
Well, at least there developed means to try to preserve buildings. Stuff still fell, but yes, and now we have, you know, historic preservation districts. We have a historic preservation commission. There's all of that sort of government existence and agencies to at least review and in some cases try to oppose the destruction of historic buildings.
One final quick question for you here. If you're smart when it comes to architecture. If we were to build, they listed it at $500,000 in 62. If we did a modern version with modern stuff like this, try to build a similar building to that, how much do you think it would cost today?
Well, if you want to try to do a modern version, one of the questions would be, you know, what do you do with the exterior? Nobody builds 4-foot thick stone walls anymore, so you'd probably be talking about some sort of a stone veneer. I don't know. We're talking into the many millions for a building like that with the amount of iron work and detailing. You tell me, 30 million, 40 million. Yeah. I mean, I have no idea.
It would be
very expensive.
It would. And it's just, and what a loss. But, you know, like I said, sometimes the true legacy is that we learned our lesson, at least to a point we did.
Yeah, to a point, I think, would be the fair way to say it.
Metropolitan Dreams, The Scandalous Rise and Stunning Fall of a Minneapolis Masterpiece. Larry Millett, once again, find this book also, Minnesota Modern Architecture and Life at Mid-Century, a fantastic book. Once There Were Castles, another fantastic book. And in its 26-year, Lost Twin Cities, which I love. And by the way, my daughter wanted to say, make sure I said hi to you, because she loves your books as well. They're just
great.
They're wonderful books. And, and of course, your Sherlock Holmes books, too. Sherlock Holmes books. We love those books. So if you can find anything from Larry Millett, it's a high recommend for me. Larry, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Good to chat with you. We'll take a break. Come on back.